Did you know that Rabble.ca is holding a donation drive right now? If you like to support independent media and you want us around, dig into your wallet. You can donate at rabble.ca/membership. Now let's begin.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
With the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver just underway, the spotlight seems to be shining most on Canada's lugers, downhillers, and skaters. Here at the Alternatives Podcast, however, we'd like to remind the world that Canada has produced more than its fair share of gold medal environmentalists. The Canadian Green Team flag bearer would likely be David Suzuki, who, like Wayne Gretzky, needs no introduction anywhere. Another of our eco-stars is William Reese, who came up with the now well-known concept of the ecological footprint. We recently interviewed Reese for the New Ecology podcast. And in this podcast, we're pleased to feature another Canadian who's permanently enshrined in the environmental pantheon, C.S. Buzz Halling. As an ecological economist, one of Halling's greatest contributions to environmental thinking has been the concept of resilience, which he first introduced in a paper in 1973. Resilience in ecology, according to another article in this issue, is the ability to absorb and learn from disturbances, to be changed and then reorganize, and still retain basic structure and ways of functioning. A well-known example of an ecosystem that was pushed past its point of resilience to devastating effect is the Atlantic cod fishery. Crawford Stanley Halling was born in the United States to Canadian parents and grew up in Northern Ontario. He studied at the University of Toronto before receiving his PhD at the University of British Columbia. After working for a period in the forest products industry, Halling returned to academia and research, first at UBC and finally at the University of Florida. In preparation for her feature print interview in the Resilience issue of Alternatives Journal, executive editor Nicola Ross reached Buzz Halling by telephone at his home in Nanaimo on Vancouver Island. We're pleased to present that full interview here as a standalone podcast.
Dr. Halling, your academic career spans 6 decades. Would you say you're now retired?
Sure, I'm retired. I've been retired since I started.
So what does that mean? That means
I do things that are fun to do and enjoyable and satisfy my curiosity.
And why are you now in Nanaimo?
Two reasons. One was escaping the eroding political situation in the United States, which I found very distasteful, though it now is changing, perhaps.
Yeah, let's hope.
And the second reason is to be near 2 children and their partners, and 2 grand twins in Nanaimo, British Columbia.
Ah, the plot thickens. So right. How long have you been in Nanaimo?
About 1.5 years now, and we've just, in fact, tomorrow, we moved into one house which we ended up not liking, so we sold it, and it's selling tomorrow.
Oh, my.
Closing tomorrow.
Wow, well, you're lucky to sell. I don't think anything's sold in this part of the world for the last 3 months.
And very little here. Now we're in a lovely house that sits on the edge of a cliff overlooking a Douglas fir forest that recedes down to the Gulf of Georgia. And then I'm looking out there now, and beyond the Gulf of Georgia is glimmering lights of Vancouver.
Oh, my word. Well, I don't know that we're going to post this on the radio for another few months, but at the moment we're amidst yet another snowstorm in Toronto. So,
oh, God.
At any rate, what I'd like to do is move on to some maybe more weighty questions, although moving back to Canada is probably fairly weighty. I've done some research, you know, into some of your studies, needless to say, and in one place, you write, and it's a sentence that intrigued me, and you wrote, novelty emerges from the interaction between opportunity and crisis. And I just have a couple of questions on that concept. And first of all, can you explain what you mean or what's wonderful about novelty?
Yeah, no, I mean something specific about novelty. Novelty, to me, combines invention that can operate continuously and emergence of invention into some social activity. So novelty, to me, is something that is new and something that emerges from invention. The reason that sentence links crisis and opportunities is that novelty typically, I think, only emerges when there's from this sea of invention that exists, only emerges when there is some sort of crisis that makes people attend and seek for new ways of doing things.
So crisis is a good thing.
Crisis, to me, is both creative and destructive. It destroys accumulated rigidities, but it is creative in the sense that it utilizes the accumulated capital for new opportunity.
So it forces invention in a
right
in a sense. Well, I believe you came up with a word to describe this interaction between opportunity and crisis, did you not?
There's two words that capture it, really. One, the more specific word, was actually invented by an economist in the 1930s, Schwertfeger, Austrian, and he called it creative destruction.
Hmm.
And it applied to what he was talking about of international and multinational organizations. So creative destruction is a wonderful word that captures what I see as well. The more general word is panarchy.
Yes. That was the one I was thinking about. So what do you mean by panarchy?
Panarchy is a wonderful word. It's an invention that combines the Greek god Pan, who is the god of nature and mischievous and both creative and destructive himself, and combines Pan with the phrase archy, hinting at the structure of systems that go from small and fast events to slow and big events.
Now, I looked up panarchy in my Canadian Oxford Dictionary, and I couldn't find it.
No, we invented the name.
and you haven't? Have you applied to have it become a real word?
No, we have not.
Well, maybe.
No, the book that emerged from the collaborative study is entitled Panarchy,
yes.
And it's doing very well. It's amazing. It sells every year a substantial amount.
Well, I wonder if it will have a resurgence in our current economic crisis.
Well, it's relevant.
Mm-hmm, very relevant. Well, I have some questions about that to come, but I wanted to move on to another concept that you talk about that caught my attention, and that is you say that we want rare transformations, not simple change. And I wonder if you can comment on that. And my real question there is this something we can design for, or is this something that just happens?
A good question. Okay, the difference between change and transformation. There, from our work, we see three kinds of, in general, change. One kind of change is very incremental and slow, and that's very common and terribly important. The second is more disruptive, and that has to do when there has been in a business, say, a saturation of markets, or in an ecosystem, an over-maturity of a forest, in which it then transforms through often, or it not transforms, it changes through some event like forest fires or a declaration of the board of stockholders. And then the third kind is transformation, which is still deeper than any of the other two, and involves a change in the panarchy, that is, in the structure of relationships across scale. Changes in relationships that go, typically, when we think of these things, affect government and institutions and social organizations.
Can you give us an example of this sort of transformation?
Mm-hmm. In a social system, basically, you can range from examples of societies that have, during millennia, collapsed, the Mayan civilization, mm-hmm. for example, as it moved to a state of increasing rigidity and organization, such that even if some change was needed, the structure was such that it became impossible to do so.
Uh-huh.
The politics and, in their case, the religious relationships prevented any exercise of actions that could transform that society in a more constructive way. So gradually it collapsed from the top down until the families, or the individuals even, were left as the only major unit. Contrast that to a transformation that moved, say, the hunting and gathering societies of humanity into a series of steps into agricultural and then mm-hmm. industrial. Those two were transformations of a large sort.
And are we amidst another one?
I think we are in the midst of another one. It might not be as great and deep as a transformation of from hunting and gatherer into agriculture, but it is a major economic, social, and environmental transformation.
And what sort of, can you take a stab, or do you have an idea on where we're headed?
Only in the sense that we're headed into a direction of considerable unknown. That's the feature of the theory itself and its discoveries, that there's things you know and are confident in. There's things that are uncertain, where you're not sure how important they are. And there's other things that are just simply unknown.
Unknown
and when you
unknowns.
Move into a transformation of this kind, this mm-hmm. panarchical kind, you're moving into a world of deep unknowns. You know some things you need to do, like you need to control the rigidities and stop them from inhibiting change. You know you have to protect the sources of knowledge you'll draw upon. You'll have to introduce experiments, efforts to test out various ideas, various inventions, various discoveries that are not incorporated into society yet, but could be and could synergize with others to set in place the stages for the next transformation. It is inherently unknown, but it's discoverable.
But isn't human nature to avoid unknowns? I mean, I think of, we had a new budget yesterday, and I wonder if all the effort is going to maintain the status quo. When do we start to embrace unknowns or see them as opportunity, I guess?
Well, remember, there's such a thing as a human creature called an explorer.
Mm-hmm.
And the explorer is an example of an individual who really journeys into the unknown. There's also the example of a person called an innovative scientist
mm-hmm.
who similarly journeys into landscapes of the mind that are truly unknown. So the unknown and the search for the unknown and the enjoyment of the unknown isn't non-existent when it's in the human situation. But nevertheless, your point is very important. There is a great resistance to transformative change, and there will be strong efforts on existing power bases to prevent any kind of transformative change.
And do you see anybody or any people on the horizon that may be the explorers?
Oh, now, yes, I do. I see in the scientific field. One example is the Resilience Alliance, which mm-hmm. is an association of 17 groups from around the world that exists entirely everywhere and nowhere because it's entirely on the net,
virtually.
On the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And it combines a group of several hundred younger and older scientists and economists and mathematicians who have learned to be friends amongst each other and to enjoy these journeys into the unknown and these journeys of discovery. So
and
that's
are
a
they?
Classic example of a innovative group that benefits from the discoveries that are opened at times of crisis.
And are they cross-discipline? Do the people within the Resilience Alliance cross disciplines, whether they're economists or ecologists or?
Yeah, they all are. I use the word economist and mathematician and so on and so on and so forth, because very often their training was through that route. But their interests are interdisciplinary.
Mm-hmm.
Their great pleasure is in efforts of mutual discovery, where they have some ideas that they bounce off against the ideas of others, so that there can be a cooperative synthesis. But they are basically interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary.
Mm-hmm. Well, sort of a good lead into my next question, and that is has to do with unknown unknowns, as I think they've been, or unk-unks, as I guess some people call them. And climate change seems to be sort of the ultimate example of a great unknown unknown. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I think we're in the midst of climate change now. It's very slow,
mm-hmm.
and it is a slow process measured in multiple decades unless we hit a discontinuity, which is possible, and then it can change rather rapidly. But we are in a major transformation that is reflecting the way the world is linked across space through atmospheric processes. Actually processes that link oceans, land, and atmosphere.
And within climate change, it brings those aspects together. Is that what you're... does that make it the unknown unknown, or is it just that it's so complex?
No, it's not that it's complex. It is truly moving our world into regimes of behavior that we've never seen before. So that the natural systems, so social systems, economic systems, ecological systems, have not adapted to what is emerging. So not having adapted, then the consequences of the climate changing means that the responses of the vegetation, of people, and so forth, will be inherently unpredictable.
And is this it's an expression that I love and I keep running into now. Is this when we could possibly flip attractors?
Yeah, that's the key of resilience, that you flip attractors from one state to another. And indeed, yes, when I said in my just completed remarks that the changes in climate are going to take place slowly unless there is a discontinuity, what I was referring to is one of those flips, where you can flip rapidly into a different configuration that would appear for us in this world of ours as very geographically varied kind of situation. Some regions would express it, other regions would not.
And the classic examples of flipping attractors are, I guess, honeybees, the collapse of honeybees?
Yeah, and the movement of a very common one is the way a lake in
yes.
Europe or in North America can flip from a state of clarity with a variety of predatory and other fish and large amounts of rooted vegetation to a turbid, plankton-dominated environment. And that can be typically is, in fact, a sudden flip. It sometimes occurs as an initial mini-flips that essentially then consolidate into a big one.
And it can
That's
virtually happen
very
overnight?
Well known, mm-hmm. And it's also known how you get out of them.
Oh, and how do you get out of them?
It always involves more than one intervention. It always involves some sort of intervention that has to do with the return of the large areas of vegetation rooted in the bottom with the emergence of a different complex of species of fish. And one, in fact, can, as has been demonstrated in Europe, choose the two or three interventions that cause the system to flip back from the nutrient-enhanced planktonic soup into this clear water, multi-species environment.
But you have to address it on more than one plane,
right?
Is that?
Yeah, on more than one range and more than one spatial scale.
Well, let's get back to climate change. Now, we're amidst a process, the Kyoto process, I suppose, on trying to manage or otherwise cope with climate change. Are you able to comment on how effective the process that we have in place to handle climate change is, whether on an international or even a Canadian basis?
It has to be done, and it is happening now. And it is happening more and more strongly. It's been up to this point quite ineffective, but it is and will become somewhat more effective as time progresses. But the key now is not only that. That should continue, and it's necessary. But the key is to recognize that the climate is going to change.
Yes.
It's irreversible.
Mm-hmm.
It might change a lot or a little. The amount is questionable and might change in one direction in one region and another direction in another. But it is in the process of changing. So the second set of things one needs to do is adaptive experiments. That is, experiments that assume there will be a climate change, that there will be effects from that climate change, and inventive experiments that can benefit from it. For example, it's been reasonably well established that the diversity of species in the Finno-Scandinavian forests has been sharply reduced as a consequence of the forest management. At this stage of climate changing, it's quite possible to imagine establishing invasion pathways by which various species can naturally move into those forests from south to north as a natural process. But it would require communities to decide to do that and to provide those protective corridors. Another example is salmon on the west coast of North America, and well, Canada, really, and Alaska, that the southern populations of some species of those salmon have been sharply reduced. As climate change occurs, they will be even more sharply reduced, and that the population distribution will move more and more northward. They could move as far north as to establish the Mackenzie River as one of the spawning beds, in which case another set of experiments suggest themselves of maintaining attributes along those northern flowing rivers that would provide a sustaining source of reproduction and spawning for salmon.
And so we need to experiment with those. Is that
exactly
what you're suggesting?
Exactly.
And is that work being done? We're hearing more and more about adaptation, not just mitigation in terms of climate change.
We are hearing more and more, and that's very, 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 very encouraging. I don't know that anything has been done yet on any significant way, except through this process that we're involved in, is in discussing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I anticipate in the future that will emerge as a more and more common and powerful effort.
But on the, I guess, the political process in terms of handling climate change on an international basis, is that an effective process to deal with an unknown unknown?
Oh, it's a difficult question. It's a partially successful, let me say that. The more dramatic the change needed, of course, the more difficult it is. It's an unavoidable process. The political system has, the international political system, has to adapt. But at the moment, I think we'd have to recognize that the political changes required will be too slow internationally. They should continue. The efforts to change them should continue. But that in addition to doing that is identifying and, where one can, implement these more regional experiments that address global issues.
And move forward at our own pace outside of the formal process.
Right.
Well, that leads me again into my next, and this is the role of research organizations. And one of the things you write about research organizations is that they change over time. They start out being novel, and they can become stale. I think you've experienced that in your own research career. And I wonder if this is a form of flipping attractors.
Yeah, I think it is. In fact, many of the ideas I've had and have published on and using ecological or economic information and data, the initial idea really came from the experience I had in organizations, which do go through that process of an initial pioneering stage of great innovation and great invention and novelty through a slow progress of accumulating reputation and papers and results, to the point where more and more groups depend upon that organization continuing as it was. So they become very, very, very difficult to change. They become very much embedded in a particular way of doing things. I found that the ideas, novel ideas that continually appear, often move to some other organization that is in an early phase of development. And the organization that generated those ideas or generated the environment for those ideas continues, but in a less productive way. So I see those organizations going through that same cycle. And I've happened in my career to have been in about, I guess, six different organizations. Often, in all cases, when I think seriously about it, I entered it when they were early in their pioneering phase, and I left them as they started to show the signs of becoming more and more rigid. So I myself have flipped and jumped from organization to organization, following the path of the innovative phase of an organization.
I was when I was preparing for this interview, I was thinking about organizations, and I was thinking, are you familiar with the Mountain Equipment Co-op? Comes from
I know it, yes.
And I was wondering, with that organization, they've been around, I don't know how many years now, quite a few, and I wonder, how does an organization like that stay innovated? Because they were such an innovative organization, and now we're kind of mainstream. Is that sort of an example of... You know,
I guess that would be an example of a situation where in manufacturing or in retail sales, where a new product line or product combination with a new way of marketing it and selling it starts to take over and explode. It will get to the point, I suppose, I don't know what its status is now, but the point where there's enough competitors that their rate of profit increase will slow. The board of directors will typically, whether in this case or not, I don't know, will typically become disturbed and ask for some sort of transformation. Typically, those transformations occur without the ability to see what they should transform into. And so the result is the organization begins to slow, and often the chief executive officer moves on and a new person appears. People are fired to cut costs, which may or may not be successful. Often it is not successful, and those organizations will, if under real market forces, they will in fact collapse.
And in this case, in the Mountain Equipment Co-op case, the CEO has left and is now heading up the David Suzuki Foundation, which is interesting that he has moved on.
Now, what has it done?
The chief executive officer of Peter Robinson of the Mountain Equipment Co-op left the organization recently and is now the executive director of the David Suzuki Foundation.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, that follows this line, as I'm suggesting.
Mm-hmm. Are there any research organizations, working in the areas of your study in ecology that you see are the innovators at this time, where the great work is happening or great ideas are coming forward?
Yeah, there are some. Offhand, I can think of three, but there's more as well. The three I think of just instantly. One of them actually is in Canada, the new Social Innovation Center established at the University of Waterloo that is promising just extraordinary ideas and changes. Francis Wesley is in charge of that. The second is the International Coral Reef Center in Australia, mm-hmm. Townsville, Australia, that has become a remarkable center for both research and for the design of policies in the Great Barrier Reef that can reintroduce and sustain resilience in those systems. And the third, and probably the most extensive of all, is the Stockholm Resilience Center in Stockholm emerged about a year and a half ago, I guess, and recently had organized and hosted the first resilience conference in the world that was just remarkable in the number of people it attracted and the quality of the science presented. And it's an example of an truly interdisciplinary group. They look at the interaction between the social, economic, and ecological elements of problems and opportunities. They're international. The faculty and students are drawn from all around the world. And they're just great and great fun, too.
Well, let me take you back to the University of Waterloo, since Alternatives Journal is on campus, and actually Francis Wesley's office is just across the... across the way from me. Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
we're housed in the Faculty of Environment at the University of Waterloo. And one of the things that you wrote about Frances Wesley, you mentioned that she suggested there are three types of scientists: consolidators,
yeah.
technical talents, and artists.
Yeah.
And I had always sort of felt that the successful scientists were the most skeptical, or were the skeptics, and you seem to feel differently on that. Can you just go there?
Well, you're absolutely right. She is right, and you are right.
Uh-huh.
The main body of science was established and evolved to be skeptical of anecdote. It was the solution to the kind of anecdotes that are continually appearing to explain some phenomena of nature. And they are just simply anecdotes. They have no touch with reality. So the scientific method, the basic scientific method, as described by experimental approaches particularly, laboratory experimental approaches, is a way to get rigorous understandings that are testable and legitimate. So a major body of science, both the training and the application, is in that mode of this skeptical... the effort to be deeply skeptical about and therefore control the damage from anecdote.
Mm-hmm.
But the real feature of science has emerged as well to be the appearance of totally novel theories and inventions. Those don't come out of skepticism. They come out of some sort of visionary activity of an individual who has some scientific background as well, but who is less constrained by the need to be skeptical, and yet can combine that vigor of vision and embracing the unknown with some sort of tests to make sure that the reality doesn't disappear behind what they're doing.
And that's
these
how you
are the artists.
That's how you describe yourself, I think, is it not?
Well, I would be honored to be so considered.
Well, I know I myself am not a skeptic. I have to rely on other people to be skeptical. Whatever crosses my desk, I always think it's wonderful. So I loved
you.
Your words. I thought
good
maybe I'm okay.
Yeah, that's great.
I just have
certainly in my career, I have great respect for scientific skeptics, great respect, but they have in my own work, frustrated me deeply at various times. And it's usually in this, the work that I've done, that part of that work that I see as being really innovative. It's typically taken 25 to 30 years before it got through the cloud of skepticism and became embraced as an integral part of existing knowledge.
And do we have the time? Do we have the you know, can we afford that much time on an issue such as climate change?
Yes, I think we do have the time. Climate change, well, let me hesitate again. So long as climate change occurs at the pace that we expect, which isn't necessarily true, then we do have the time. If, as is entirely possible, unexpected processes suddenly flip the system so that the changes occur much more rapidly, then we will be in difficulty, and we'll need the most ebullient and powerful ways of inventing and resisting the forces that prevent invention or slow invention as possible.
If we have the opportunity to do that, I guess that's the risk. If there's a series of domino effects.
Yeah, no, exactly so. No, but I always feel, and now I'm moving not into science, but just simply into faith, really. I always feel it's so important to be optimistic. Of course, there's pessimistic things happening. But if you don't have some optimism, then you can guarantee what will result will be the worst you expect. So I tend to, in this effort to emphasize that destruction is combined with creation, emphasize the positive opportunities.
Well, and we have to wake up in the morning and spend the day, and it's easier being optimistic than...
Yeah, absolutely. More fun, too.
Exactly. Kind of a next-to-last question, and another thing you talk about is that transformation is not easy and gradual, it's tough and abrupt. Can you relate that to our current economic crisis, if I can call
that? Oh,
that's
a classic example. Here's the crisis that really started roughly a year, maybe a little more than a year ago, though people were not aware of it. They only became aware really around September when financial structures started to collapse. But there's a typical example of a long process that I trace back to the collapse of the Berlin Wall.
Wow.
And I'll tell you in a moment why I picked that as the image. Back to the collapse of the Berlin Wall, what, 18, 20 years ago or longer, a long period of economic expansion and activity and efficiency driven largely by incremental changes and that first phase of disruptive changes that are more in terms of major learning, and a long process of accumulating resources and expanding over space until it becomes a global economic system. And then as the time progressed, more and more rigidities started to appear, and more efforts to hide those rigidities and capitalize on them. So the big property bubble that it was so utterly insane was happily engaged upon as a huge opportunity of making a hell of a lot of money. And that started the destabilization, which now then has progressed as elements have collapsed into a broader and broader set of consequences. So there's the classic example of the crisis of a transformative kind now, not an incremental kind, but of a transformative kind that emerged because of the rigidities that had inhibited a more moderate kind of transformation. And now we're in the big one, which has become, because of the global character of the economies, has become a global phenomenon.
So do you believe that good for the environment, for ecosystems, can come from this economic crisis necessarily or just possibly?
I'd say just possibly. Oh, my goodness, there's a deer outside the window here in my office. Lovely, lovely black-tailed deer.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it's lovely. Anyway, sorry.
Nature.
No, I think it's possible. And it's possible in the sense that if the collapse occurs in a dramatic and extensive way so that the economic system becomes partially disengaged, then the intensity of economic impact on the environment will weaken. But one hopes for something deeper than that. One hopes for a more integrative understanding and an integrative approach to the way humans relate to their world and the way the world, in fact, relates back to humans.
If we can listen, I suppose. Well, I just to close things off, I just wonder if you can share with us what's your next project? What are you working on, or you know, where are your insights leading you?
Well, right now, the big thing that has been engaging my thoughts is the next annual meeting of the Resilience Alliance, which is being held here on Gabriola Island, a few miles away from our home, in September.
Oh, my.
As part of that meeting of people from all around the world is a special pre-meeting meeting involving the Aboriginal groups on the west coast of Vancouver Island associated with Clayoquot Sound. Now, many Canadians and many environmentalists will know that name as being the example of probably the most extreme environmental protest in Canada with the logging industry.
Yes.
That ended up with logging industry removing itself from the area and leaving a small company that the Aboriginals run. And it's an example of a set of events of transformative character, each one, that have been really very full of this crisis and opportunity that we've been talking about. And it's to those people are designing a life that will, whose goal it is to retain and develop their native cultural discoveries with some economic survivability and maintenance of the natural environment.
So this will be this.
So we will be meeting there, and our problem has been to get the extra resources needed to move our group from where we can bring them here in Gabriola Island over the island to Tofino.
So
that's what's engaging my attention right at the moment.
Well, I'd love to be a fly on the wall at that meeting.
Oh, it's going to be fun.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate your taking the time and talking to me. Thanks very much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Oh, not at all, Nicola. You're doing a wonderful job.
Before we sign off, I want to encourage all podcast listeners to consider subscribing to the print version of the magazine, either online or in hard copy form. Each issue contains a wealth of articles, only a few of which we're able to feature here on the podcast. And of course, audio, as much as we love it, can never do justice to the magazine's fabulous design and graphics and stunning photography. So please, go to the website, consider a subscription. Thank you once again for listening. I'm Peter Stocks.